The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 61, Mormonism and Genetics, by Mary V. Rorty.
She has some slides, and I think from the outline, a very interesting presentation. So I present to you Mary Rorty.
Probably one of the few people who's going to read their paper, so pinch yourselves. It's probably going to be comparatively boring to the compared to the lively discussions that I've heard in a more informal fashion. At the University of Virginia, I had a colleague who was very interested in the history of genetics and knows that I'm a Mormon. So for a number of years, he's been collecting articles from me from the turn-of-the-century professional journals that refer to eugenics in the context of Mormonism. And he's come up with some very interesting stuff. In this paper, I want to talk about a little bit about what we looked like to early eugenicists, and then talk about why those issues are of interest to us today. It's not a scholarly paper, really. It's just an excuse for sharing some of my favorite passages. It's sort of a hobbyist paper about an issue that is as important today as it ever was. I'm going to talk about Mormonism and eugenics, eugenics and genetics, and Mormonism and genetics. There's an outline on the back of the room some of you may have. I don't want to pretend that there's a lot of historical material available, but there is some. And I'm citing from three articles. They are listed at the bottom under references, the first three references on that outline. The first one is called Brigham Young, An Illustration of Prepotency. The second one is called The Offspring of the Mormon People. And the third one is called Eugenics and Mormonism. The term eugenics was coined by Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin, in 1883. The word comes from the Greek, and it's usually translated well-born. Galton wanted to have a short word to refer to a new science that was intended to devote itself to the good of the species, the task of improving this human stock, by what he called judicious mating, of course, but also by taking into account other factors which might, and I quote, give the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable. Eugenics was two things. It was a struggling scientific movement involving many distinguished biologists, physicians, and social scientists. And it was a social movement based on and around that science. It was the form that genetic science took in the first half of the 20th century. Historians of science speak of eugenics as having two faces: positive eugenics, encouraging the birth of children with heritable characteristics that might be hoped to improve the species, and negative eugenics, discouraging the birth of children with heritable, potentially undesirable characteristics, thus getting them out of the population pool. At that moment in history, of course, the science was pretty unreliable. There was a lot of confusion about what traits were heritable and what traits were not, as indeed there still is today. Much of who we are comes from the impact of the environment on us. Much, too, comes from our socialization, our family influences. The borderline between nature and nurture is and has always been very hard to draw. But among the traits considered by early eugenicists as heritable were deafness, chronoplasia, that's dwarfism, blindness, feeble-mindedness, laziness, shiftlessness, criminality, drunkenness, and, very important, poverty. The one I like best, there's a propensity to follow certain vocations, sailor, for instance, or lawyer, or physician. Those were also thought to be heritable genetic traits. But because of the influence of Darwin, of Mendel, and some of the early geneticists, there was a great deal of theoretical impetus behind this early young science, and with many scientific theories, a great deal of public interest as well in the social application of the scientific theories. The American eugenics movement had its epicenter in the Eugenics Record Office in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, which was established in 1910. The American branch of eugenics differed from its English parent science in several respects. In England, the main emphasis was on class markers, and the main task was to encourage the upper classes to reproduce at a higher rate. In America, a land of immigrants, the strongest focus was on race and ethnicity, and the form it took was primarily negative eugenics, discouraging the marriage, or at least the reproduction, of the genetically inferior. The first compulsory sterilization laws in the United States was passed in 1907 in Indiana. By 1931, some 30 states had compulsory sterilization laws on the books, although many of them were unenforced. Over the next 50 years, some sources estimate that about 60,000 people were involuntarily sterilized under such laws, one-third of them in California. And as late as 1985, 19 states still had such laws. Hitler undertook even more extensive eugenic projects, which took the form not only of sterilization but of wholesale elimination in the Holocaust of adults and children who had been diagnosed as disabled or mentally ill, or were of undesirable races, including Jews and Gypsies. Historians have traced his theories to his readings of and his relations with American eugenicists in the early part of the century. But there was positive eugenics in America as well. There are marvelous photographs of the winners of fitter families contests in county and state fairs, modeled upon the livestock and the produce shows at those same fairs, where the winners receive the same blue ribbons as were handed out to the best cows and the best begonias. Positive eugenics was intended to encourage the fit. For that read, handsome, healthy, successful, well-to-do, to marry each other and to have large families. It was the positive eugenicists that loved the Mormons. They loved them for their theories, and they loved them for their practices. After all, if you were looking around the country for fit families, you would have found a lot of them in early 20th century in Utah. And they might very well be quite large families, too. The importance of family trees for tracing heritable traits was extremely important for the struggling young science, and the Mormons are among the most industrious and careful of genealogists. As the earliest article in 1916 notes, as it is for them a duty to work for the eternal happiness of one's ancestors, and as those ancestors must be known if intercession is to be made for them, it results that every Mormon takes a practical interest in genealogy, and among the women of the church particularly, familiarity with the genealogical methods is probably more widespread than among any other class of people in the United States. And if you're interested in heritable traits, polygamy has a fundamental advantage of offering data about the offspring of a single husband and several wives, and thus produced, and I quote, a large body of material of extraordinary value to the eugenicist. The article from which I'm quoting is Brigham Young, An Illustration of Prepotency. The phenomenon of prepotency is particularly familiar, as the author notes, to breeders of livestock. But in the human species as well, everyone can cite instances where all the children of the family take strongly after one parent or another. But never, perhaps, was the phenomenon of prepotency more graphically shown in man than in the accompanying photograph of 11 daughters of Brigham Young by 8 different wives. Notice the chin.
Oh,
different their mothers were, writes a member of the American Breeders Association, the early, this is the early name of the American Eugenics Society. But all of the daughters are distinctly Youngs in feature, voice, appearance, and temperament. All are musical. All are amiable. All are adaptable, genuine, sincere, temperamental, yet reasonable, and are good mimics. All are warm-hearted, generous, excellent cooks and housewives, and have the reputation of being attractive, magnetic, and sympathetic. None is great as their father was great, but all are Youngs. The author then tells a story about a guy in Seattle who bet his companion $25 that the two women he saw approaching him on the street were Brigham Young's daughters. Upon accosting them, he learned that they were in fact granddaughters through the eldest son, Brigham, and he won his bet. Now, the science of eugenics is a population science. This means that it depends heavily on the use of statistics to bolster its conclusions. It's an early variety, I suppose, of what we might call epidemiology. The author of the 1924 article, The Offspring of the Mormon People, was an empirical scientist. It's a very lengthy and statistically laden article, and since I hate numbers, especially if they have decimal points, I'm only going to summarize some of his conclusions of this 13-page article. The author, J. E. Hickman, weighed and compared 24,000 people, of whom 2,700 he described as of polygynous origins. He made comparisons of several sorts. He compared Utah with the rest of the country. He compared urban and rural Utahns of both polygamic and monogamic families. And finally, he compared a subset of that population, 1,200 students, of whom 700 were of monogamic origin, 300 were of polygenic origin, and 200 were second generation, which means that their parents were polygenic. He compared the 1,200 students on height, weight, and mental ability. He did the measurements of weight and height himself. He got the mental ability on the basis of information given by the instructors on their grade averages and their standing in the class. His statistics reveal that the male students of what he called Class P, polygenic, are 3 inches taller, 8 pounds heavier, and 7% above those in Class M in school marks. The results for the girls are as conclusive, although the differences are not quite so strong, so large. Both Class M and Class P students are also taller and heavier than comparable non-Mormon children he measured in other states. He concludes, these differences of superiority of the polygenic issue, direct and indirect, over the monogamic, are too constant and are taken from too large a class to be due to chance. Therefore, the conclusion is that the children from such a source are endowed from birth with a physical and mental advantage that manifests itself throughout the history of the individual. Moving to the Utah population at large, he compares them on the basis of the percent that attended a high school, academy, or college. Of the 20,000 offspring of the monogamic, 1 in 25 attended higher education as so defined. Of the 2,500 offspring of the polygamic, 1 in 5 attended higher education. Comparing Utah to other states, the author notes that in 1903, Utah had a greater proportion of her young people attending high schools than any other state in the Union except Nebraska. One wonders what was going on in Nebraska. And is in 1924 the third lowest state in the Union for illiteracy. Moral standards, he measures as well, and that by the number of people in each group who've committed felonies, comparing both M and P Mormons, and then comparing both to non-Mormon Utahns. The results of this crime statistics are particularly interesting. 80% of the people in Utah were Mormon at the time of the article. But according to state and national sources, They were the source of only 15% of the crimes over 35 years. And in two sample years, the results are the same. In 1880 and in 1882, I quote, in Utah and in four or five Mormon settlements in southern Idaho, 208 Mormons and 1,578 non-Mormons were arrested for offenses. Yet the Mormons furnished 80% of the population. Four-fifths of the people furnished only one-eighth of the crime. The interesting thing about all the crime statistics is that imprisonment for polygamy is not included. Because, as he notes, these men were arrested and fined on an ex post facto law. They may be classed as lawbreakers, but not as criminals. He doesn't ignore those imprisonments, though. And in fact, he begins the article with a passionate summary of the history of polygamy in Utah. In 1882, the Edmunds Law outlawing polygamy was passed, and until the time the Supreme Court sustained the constitutionality of that law, and until the manifesto in 1890, the Mormons resisted the law. During that period, I quote, over 2,500 men were imprisoned. At one time, the penitentiaries in Arizona, Utah, and Idaho were filled with Kohabs, as they were called. In that emergency, the government chartered the state prison at Detroit, Michigan, and sent many of the prisoners there. Of the thousands imprisoned, he says, liberty and amnesty were offered to each if he would abandon his wives and children. But be it to their honor, not one accepted the olive branch at such a sacrifice. The author concludes the article as follows. This is, in brief, the summation of the work that occupied the writer's attention every spare moment for nearly 7 years. His investigations were made with a view of knowing the truth concerning the Mormon offspring, of which there has been so much said and written, accusations and rebuttals, charges and countercharges, until the people are covered with the calumny of their accusers. You may ask for a cause of the startling results of such marriages. To your inquiry, the writer may say that he has but little data on the subject. Yet in brief, the cause in part may be accounted for by the fact that it was due to noble men and women who entered this principle, women who sought noble companions and longed to bear the souls of men into the world. They loved them into the world. They blessed their coming. In keeping with this thought, a professor has said, it is quite evident that your noblest men and women have entered that principle. My colleague who sent me this suggested that this article may have been written by a member. It was not only the practices of Mormonism that attracted the attention of this first generation of eugenic scientists. The doctrines that underlay some of their social practice were of interest as well. The last of the three articles, entitled Eugenics and Mormonism, was written in 1928. The author, Roswell H. Johnson, considers polygamy of little interest. There are at that point, he maintains, only between 200 and 300 women who are plural wives, most of them beyond the age of childbearing, with death rapidly thinning their numbers. Of much more interest to this author is the attitude of Mormons towards marriage and birth. The doctrine of eternal progression heads his list. That doctrine, as he describes it, views procreation as the provision of bodies for already extant spirits who come to earth to get bodies as one stage in their pre- and post-earth progression. He quotes Brigham Young as having urged members that in order to prepare tabernacles for them, they should take a course that will not tend to drive those spirits into the families of the wicked, which might hamper their progress. The importance of marriage is central to the doctrine of eternal progression, as he describes it. Only those who were married on earth are eligible for godhood. marriage is not only to one's individual advantage then, but to the advantage of one of the other partner as well. He quotes Joseph F. Smith as having said, "We believe that every man holding the holy priesthood should be married, with a very few exceptions of those who, through infirmities of mind or body, are not fit for marriage." So, in this church, celibacy is low, marriage tends to be very young, and he concludes from his rather scanty field work, which, so far as I can tell, consisted of asking about the families of one summer session of students at the University of Utah. Family size tends to be almost three times that of Protestant families. One cause for this marvelous eugenic situation is that the church has, this is a quote, "The church has in its young people's organizations made a definite and systematic effort to teach better mate selection." He cites particularly a lesson on marriage standards prepared by Claude Richards in the Granite State. Further, sex is not considered indecent, quote, "as is the implication of so many religious cults." So it's not the case that in Mormonism that the most idealistic members are driven into celibacy, thus, I assume, taking their heritable characteristics out of the gene pool. Despite these obvious advantages and strengths from the perspective of improving the race, Mormonism faces two threats to its otherwise excellent practice. The author worries about the effect of possible fundamentalism, and I quote, "So long as the Mormon stock is as good as it is now, the results of their high fecundity will be eugenic. But suppose the tenacious adherence to the literal detail of Bible and Mormon scripture, held by some Mormon literalists, should become more widespread. Then the scientific spirit of the age now pervading the youth would cause a reselection of the Mormon personnel, in that only the relatively less intellectual would remain or be allowed to remain to continue in the Mormon church, and only less intellectual persons would be converts. In that case, the result would be dis-eugenic." The other threat is from what he describes as the very effective Women's Relief Society, which now doles out money and other forms of support to many morons and feeble-minded and other defectives, and intolerates in this way the production of defective children. This, he argues, is unsound from the standpoint of Mormon theory, and he cites in support of this claim Apostle Parley P. Pratt, who is quoted as saying, "The law of God would not suffer the idiot, the confirmed irredeemable drunkard, the man of hereditary disease or of vicious habits, to possess or retain a wife." In the key to the science of theology. The author then urges the Relief Society to make aid conditional on an assurance that there will be no reproduction by segregation, sterilization, or approved contraception. He praises Utah for having an institution in which sterilization of some of its inmates is authorized, but he laments that the number of those treated is so small. I think it's only fair to note here that, in the first place, the law authorizing such sterilizations had been passed only like 1925, so there was only 3 years of practice. He may have been happier if it had been a longer distance, but the church of that period, on the whole, did seem to be, in general, much more committed to the positive rather than the negative face of eugenics. What they were interested in was the super fecundity of the faithful, a stance that was probably very wishy-washy from the standpoint of a committed eugenicist. So much for the readings from the history of eugenics in the early part of the last century. The history of eugenics is not entirely positive. The science of the times, as I suggested at the beginning, was not adequate to sufficiently differentiate hereditary traits and behaviors from environmental or socialized ones. The net result, especially for negative eugenics, was often to conceal racist and classist prejudices and discrimination in a pseudo-scientific cloak. Indeed, after World War II and public revelations of the atrocities of the Holocaust in Germany, with 6 million dead for the sake of racial purity and improvement of the Aryan race, the very term eugenics fell completely into disrepute. When we seek for heritable traits today, we do it under the label of genetics, not of eugenics. There's been a contemporary reevaluation of the historical period from which I've been quoting as well, and a reexamination and the eventual elimination of some of the social engineering practices associated with it. Early positive eugenicists loved polygamy, but if you look under Mormon eugenics on Google, which is today's substitute for yellowing journal pages, you'll find as the first listing, indeed, I think the first 12 listings, a recent book by Linda Walker called Fatal Inheritance, Mormon Eugenics, in which she blames polygamy for many of the ills of the present generation of Utah residents. Her claim is that because polygamy had to go underground, records were not kept of the genetic inheritance. And so there was inadvertent inbreeding leading to, what is it, a couple of five, six generations down the line, leading to heritable birth defects that were caused by I suppose you have to say, the genetics and the history of polygamy. Early negative eugenicists encouraged compulsory sterilization, but despite Oliver Wendell Holmes's judgment in the Supreme Court case Buck v. Bell that three generations of idiot is enough, Americans' history of legalizing eugenic sterilizations has become a source of shame for contemporaries. On March 11th of this year, 3 hours after listening to my colleague from the University of Virginia speak about the history of involuntary eugenic sterilization, Governor Gray Davis of California issued an apology to the victims of the California law legalizing eugenic sterilization, making California the fifth state to issue such an apology. In our current liberal constitutional state, we try to be very conscious of our class and our race biases. We acknowledge that the only heritable cause of poverty is very often that the people didn't inherit any money. And I suspect that as you listened to some of the passages I was quoting from 80 and 90 years ago, you thought that we'd maybe grown more tolerant, more sensitive to people's rights, and more scientifically sophisticated. And indeed, one hopes that we have. But I wanted to raise the specter of our eugenic past for several reasons. First, our past is still with us. And although the eugenics of the past, through advances in science and terminological transformations, has become the genetics of the present, many of the ethical issues associated with it are as alive today as they were at the turn of the century. We need to know our history, lest we be doomed to repeat it. Second, we're living in the age of rapid advances in genetic science and in the nation where many of them are being made. The human genome was mapped in its entirety in February of 2001, an extraordinary accomplishment, but only the very first step of what is anticipated to be a great advance in our understanding of human health and disease. Molecular genetics is the new young science of this century, as eugenics was of the last. And like eugenics in its day, it has a great deal of scientific investment and a great deal of public interest. The current biotechnological advances are being financed in very large part by our tax money and are focused very heavily on human genetic sciences, molecular medicine, genetic therapies, human stem cell research. There's a lot of science fiction on the science pages of our major newspapers and periodicals, and a lot of what we call in my trade consequentialist thinking, that is, justification of present actions by anticipated, or at least hoped for, future consequences and results. There's a third reason for wanting to discuss eugenics and genetics in this scientific, this particular scientifically advanced and technology-heavy society. That is that the United States, unlike practically any other developed nation, does not regulate reproductive technologies. The tendency here is to leave all reproductive decisions up to the parents, an approach that Europeans, in much more highly regulated societies, are beginning to call liberal eugenics. And because of the absence of any legal limits on reproductive decisions, decisions about whether to embark upon genetic therapies, removing disadvantageous genetic genes, or genetic enhancements, improving the genes that you've already got, as they become to be scientifically and methodologically feasible in the future, are going to be made by us as individuals. And if not us, then our children, for their children and for our grandchildren. There's a problem as well for our obligations as citizens of the country, of this country. On the national level, heated debates are currently going on in state and national legislative bodies, in independently constituted advisory committees, and certainly on the international level in the UN, in the European Union, and in many individual European states about what policies should govern human genetic research, research that may influence the future of the species, and research that in our present state of knowledge is the equivalent of human experimentation. Now, so far as I know, the Church has not taken a position on any of the current debates that are guiding the future path of genetic research. So it's up to us as individuals, as progenitors and as citizens, to educate ourselves, to think about eugenics and genetics, and to figure out what the relevance of the new genetics is to our lives and the lives of our families, and what the social implications might be for ourselves and our fellow citizens.
The audience is listed as the respondent for this session, so we'll take comment, and we have one already, so go ahead.
The political policy for research on stem cell, some of that's gone on, has discouraged in this country some of the most brightest minds that are doing research in this to go to countries that allow it. Now, you had given something interesting that saying our country was the freest as far as comparing with some other companies. I know Warren Hatch has had some positive things. I'm just wondering about your comments on that.
The difference, you know, my point about the absence of regulation refers to all reproductive technologies, to in vitro fertilization, to fertility and infertility treatments. So none of that in this country is regulated. The question about particular research projects that involve stem cells. There's a fairly well-publicized case of a researcher from San Francisco moving to England because the regulation of what kind of research was able to be done in that country was not as strict as in this country. So there's a theoretical difference between research and reproduction, a difference that has to do with particular stages of regulation on research in this country and the stage of advance of the research in this country as well. For instance, reproductive cloning has been forbidden for safety reasons. Now, that's application of the research for reproductive purposes. The question about what kind of research is allowed to be done if there's a clear distinction between research and reproduction is a different question, and that's the crack through which some of these scientists are leaving the country and some of these issues are right falling. Yeah.
I can speak to them a little bit more regulation. I recently went to
That's on the plant and animal.
Okay, can I interject here? That was a long question that got off the tape. Would you come up and repeat it, or can you do that?
Go ahead.
I do apologize. Okay, I will restate that at the risk of boring everyone. All right, I spent some time recently in Europe with a client, looking for investors in stem cell research, and I was a bit surprised because one would expect that America looks much more like a moralistic society, if you will, than the Europeans. We, for instance, still believe in capital punishment to a large degree here, vis-a-vis the European countries. Let's put it this way, most of civilized Europe, if you will, no longer has capital punishment, right? Indeed, that was one of the issues about them turning over terrorists to us. They were afraid that we might execute some of them. So I went over to Europe thinking that it would be easier to get some investors in stem cell research, when indeed they have a different set of issues, and that is against genetically modified organisms, the public groundswell, for instance, against genetically modified crops and such, is a lot more militant over in Europe than it is here, and as a result, that has spilled over into stem cells as well, so that the U.S. is actually, compared to a number, not all, but a number of the Western European countries, more liberal in its stance on stem cell research. Yeah.
A brief question, we'll repeat. A long question, please come up. Okay.
You said the church hasn't taken a position on, I guess, the modern stem cell or cloning research or whatever, but I guess what I'd be curious is that the church is often closely identified with more fundamentalist Christians on abortion-type issues. These more fundamentalist groups have come out very strongly on this. Why hasn't the church, and can you actually articulate a rationale that from Mormon theology, maybe either supporting research or opposing it, which seems to fit better with our theology?
Yeah, the best article that I found, this one also on Google, on questions about the church's stance on things like abortion, is an article by Lester Bush in Dialogue 18. And he claims there that actually the church has been very careful not to make, very strong pronouncements about even issues like abortion, that when the church, when you think of the church as moving more strongly to the right and more like the fundamentalist Christians in some issues, it's very often the population from the bottom up, not the church from the top down. Now, some of you who are in more activist wards that may contest that claim, but I don't think there's any strong history of specific pronouncements about that. I think the closest, I was particularly curious about that in terms of the stem cell stuff. And I was very intrigued to see what Orrin Hatch's view on that was. I mean, I think of him as, probably representing a more conservative arm of Mormon opinion. And if you try to think about what the theological justifications for a strongly negative position on that might be, don't know how easy it is to think up with some of them. So I don't know how to reconcile the appearance of the church as being extremely radical on questions like abortion and their apparent unwillingness to come down on some of these issues, including selective abortion. But perhaps some of you in the audience are better able to address those issues than I. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. You.
Very short question. In the 19th century, there was a lot of marriage of first cousins in the Mormon community. I wonder if anyone has done any research on the impact of that from the genetic point of view.
Question is whether anybody has done any research on the impact of marriage of first cousins in the 19th century. I don't know of any, but this, you know, this is a sort of hobbyist production for me, and I'm not sure where I would hunt for that kind of information. I've heard rumors that the impact of incest is A, exaggerated, B, defined differently in different cultures at different times, that marriage of first cousins in some societies, including England, I think, is considered acceptable. So it may be that cousin marriages are not close enough to be problematic.
This issue of cousin marriages, I heard somewhere recently that there was a study, it said it wasn't too bad, but they're talking about the first time, just one generation of cousin marriages. It's where you have multiple generations of cousin marriages, as it sometimes occurred in Appalachia, going back to colonial times, that there's some problems. It brings out the recessive genes. A lot of bad genes are recessive. You get two of them together, there's a problem. You have just one with a bad recessive gene with a good dominant gene, the good gene dominates. And I think the Mormons' period of cousin marriages was too brief. I mean, it was basically, about a one-generation period to get into the kind of trouble that some Appalachian families have had.
It's interesting to look at the history of some of this research on cousin marriages and inbreeding as well. I think that most of us in high school or college were told about the Jukeses and the Kallikakses, families that were supposed to have been turned into hereditary monsters and idiots by generations of inbreeding. There has been historical research of the sort that my colleague in Virginia was doing on the Carrie Buck case that have revealed that in fact lots of that data was fudged, that they have identified the family that was supposed to have been, I think, the Jukeses, not the Kallikakses. They checked out the records as to whether they really were inbred and idiots, and they were inbred but not idiots. And so there's, when I talk about the difference between the science and the social movement, there was a lot of pushing, manipulating of the science to bring it in line with the social climate and the inclinations of the time. That may be another case.
In the 19th century, where they came from all sorts of different countries in Europe, different parts of the U.S. mixed in with them. So it was a diverse group coming together as a community.
I've had a lot more differences to now. Yeah.
Those changes would have occurred in one or two generations. That's huge. Inches in height and whole percentage points.
Yeah.
Has that been reproduced in any other population group?
I don't even know if anybody else has tried. One of the problems with data like that is that you don't factor in the socioeconomic factors that may explain, some of these differences in terms of better nutrition, better, more money in the family and so forth. So, I loved that article, but I wasn't particularly sure that the data could be generalized in the way that the author did it.
Yeah,
I'd be careful on that one. Yeah.
The thought that occurred to me when you were
How many of them were blonde, and is this a characteristic that we can equally attribute to the nobility of the women who married, entered into these relationships? Lots of Swedes, lots of Scandinavians and Scotch and English, in that generation. Yeah, go ahead.
One was the idea that there were certain people called to the earth from the pre-existence date to be the leaven to the loaf, And so we have Joseph Smith's idea of familial transactions that we've talked about today in some of these eugenics historical approaches. Eliza R. Snow, by the way, in Sacred Covenant, Carmen Hardy's book, has some fantastic quotes on the early eugenic thinking in Mormonism. It's right there at the very beginning, where the notion that Terrell Bloom says Joseph Smith wanted to create new people. You know, he just wanted to create a new world, a new people. You know, and
this is much too interesting to leave off. I'm sorry.
But do put Carmen Hardy on your list.
I'd love to.
So we have this notion of who has the blood of Israel, and the blood is transformed in your body, literally. I mean, that was the kind of thing of keeping the family in line, and yet this transformation of the blood, if you convert in, tied with Joseph Smith's statement that he is the welder. He wants to unify all mankind. So we have this notion of a unique tribe, and yet the goal through the temple was to unite the whole human family. And I think we have in these days, really within Mormonism today, a sociological conflict that we don't talk about very much, but we are bringing many, many more of those people into the church in our cities around the world, and we're trying to wrestle with this. I deal in religious conflict issues, and there was a group of Mormons and Muslims that I brought together in New York a few weeks ago. And after the meeting, we learned that the Muslims are greatly offended, get this, because a couple of the Mormon couples, one was a black and one was a white, and they just couldn't see it. You know, so that would have really offended the Mormons couples. You know, maybe it still does, maybe not in New York. But what I'm getting at here is this very interesting idea that we're of tying things together eugenically. So what would eugenics be going forward? Is it keeping the intelligent tribe together, or is it really mixing it up so that we have world duels? I had a friend once said, if we mix up the martini, we'll all end up looking like Mexicans, you know, in 300 years. And he said, do we want that? And I think it's an interesting thought.
I have nothing against Mexicans, but some of my best friends.
what you're suggesting is that although I have been sketching a picture of a eugenic society seeking for this in Mormonism, you're suggesting that there is within Mormonism itself a train that was, you know, accommodating this, welcoming this, you know, perhaps even originating this.
I have to make a comment here.
My grandson is half Mexican. He is going to marry a woman who is half Chinese. They are going to call their children Texicans.
What are they going to have for dinner?
Yeah, Nancy. For those of you who don't know, Leon Cass is the chairman of the President's Bioethics Committee, and he's basically a neocon, which means he's a conservative Jew, and comes out of the University of Chicago, and he's very opposed to any stem cell research. And in general, he's opposed to abortion. And one of his bits of reasoning that he exposes in his book is that he feels that we have taken the awe and the beauty out of natural reproduction, and that, you know, the world's a better place if we have some disabled and some even retarded individuals among us. On the other hand, I think most Americans are voting with their feet in the sense that we now have procedures to determine during pregnancy whether or not the child might be Down syndrome or whatever, and people are choosing abortions, particularly in fertility.
What I describe as selective abortion as contrast with elective abortion for you all.
Right.
Which is just a matter of
so I guess
indications.
Yeah, I guess my question is, do we want more disabled people in our society? Do disabled people have rights? Is the world a better place for them, or will we be better off without them? So, your that's exactly the kind of question that I'm urging you all to think about a little bit more. What do I think? Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that raised the question of selective abortion most keenly for me is that in my youth I was fairly activist in the feminist philosophical line of things, and one of the questions that's very, very interesting to feminists is what about the allowability of gender selection. Is it not a terrible thing that in India you can, or China, disproportionately large numbers of female fetuses are aborted, with the consistency of that with the extremely widely held approval of selective abortion among feminists as well, for medical indications for disabilities? Is it consistent to disapprove of selective abortion for gender and to allow it for Down syndrome, for instance?
What's the official church position on aborting a Down syndrome fetus?
I do not know if there is a church position on that, and to the best of my knowledge, there is not a church position on that. On the other hand, selective abortions are performed in Utah. They are performed, so far as I know, in every hospital in Utah, with possible exception of, I don't even know what Catholic hospitals have as their opinion on selective abortion. There are selective abortions performed in most Catholic countries, and so even nations that have strong opinions about elective abortions and forbid them will often allow selective abortions. So I do not, I will go so far as to say that the church has, has not any disapproval of selective abortion. Who has their handbook with them?
I'd appreciate it if you come up and repeat that.
I believe the handbook instructions counsels against the abortion, but whether the selective abortion, I may be in weak area, but I have not read a general handbook of instruction now in about 10 years. But I know girls who have had Down's children have been counseled not to abort.
There's a wide range of genetic, of honestly heritable and thus discernible diseases, and some of them, some of the other trisomies 13 and 18 are so extraordinarily damaging and painful to the sufferer of these diseases that there's often distinctions drawn between selective abortions for that kind of disease and selective abortions for something like Down's that may be involve less suffering to the potential person who will have that disease. Yeah.
I was a bishop a couple of years ago, and the latest reading in it is very interesting. They say in the case where the mother's life is threatened or rape, then it is a decision to be made between that person, their family, and the bishop. And the bishop. They're supposed to bring the bishop into the discussion. The idea is prayer and revelation will determine at that moment what the right thing to do is.
And that's just for questions of the mother's health. It's not a question about the health of the fetus.
The question of the mother's health and rape, they don't. I'll tell you, as a matter of fact, the fetus question is also included in that idea that you counsel with your bishop and the family.
There's a counsel with the bishop that's critical, but the decision is made by the husband.
By the husband and wife, that's correct.
There is a statement that if the child will not live,
There is a statement that if the child will not live, abortion is allowed.
I'm acquainted with a couple here in California who have a Down syndrome child that's just a few months old. They've been doing some research on it. It doesn't have anything to do with the church. I don't know what the church's position on it exactly is, but they have discovered that in Utah, they say 90%, I'm sure that's a figure of speech rather than an actual statistic, of all the Down syndrome children that there are in Utah because they don't get aborted here. But what they do say is there is a lot more in the way of services for Down syndrome children because there are so many of them here. And this couple is in the process of planning to move to Utah.
Any more comments, questions?
I have a little short story about an 11-year-old Downs boy who was asked by the social worker, what does retarded mean? And in his own words, the boy said, there are two kinds of people in my life. Most people look at me, see that I am different, look away, and pretend I don't exist. The other kind of people, second kind of people, are ones who have eye contact with me, and with them I can really get the love flowing. The first kind of people are retarded.
I think in this country there's been a lot of change of attitude towards and increasing information about the potential of Down's syndrome children, and so I'd say in the last 20 years there's been almost a complete reversal of attitudes about that. As I was saying earlier, it's not the only genetic heritable disability that comes into question for selective abortions, but it may be an interesting kind of test case for us when we start thinking about how much of our attitudes towards various genetic characteristics are, in the first place, social, and in the second place, subject to change.
Can Down syndrome children receive the priesthood?
The Lord, this is the church policy as presented in the handbook.
As a plan.
1998.
This is a handbook.
This is the current handbook. The Lord commanded, thou shalt not kill nor do anything like unto it. The church opposes elective abortion for personal or social convenience. Members must not submit to, perform, encourage, pay for, or arrange for an abortion. The only possible exceptions are when, 1, pregnancy resulted from rape or incest, 2, a competent physician determines that the life or health of the mother is in serious jeopardy, 3, a competent physician determines that the fetus has severe defects that will not allow the baby to survive beyond birth. Even these exceptions do not justify abortion automatically. Abortion is a most serious matter and should be considered only after the persons responsible have consulted with their bishops and received divine confirmation through prayer. I think that's probably that.
Is the clause still in there that anybody who participates in abortion as a teen or a physician or a nurse also subject to church discipline?
It did say anyone who performs.
Church members who submit to, perform, encourage, pay for, or arrange for an abortion may be subject to church discipline.
Our time is up. I'd like to thank Phil for
bringing us the official information. Not everybody carries this kind of stuff.
How often do you ask an audience to, if they have paper in their hand? That is incredible.
And I want to thank Mary for introducing a very interesting and significant topic, and I think we will be debating this for some time to come in the church and in a public community. So thank you very much.